Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power and money power. Now, my guest today, Barbara Garson, is a woman that has done some fascinating research regarding the recession. I prefer to call it the depression, but she may not agree with me, but I think that so many of us have gone through such tremendous challenges. She said, I agree with you, Donna. Her book is Down the Up Escalator. This is a view of the changes and challenges that various individuals have gone through. She calls it the 99%, those of us living in the great, again, this is my addition, depression, and she says recession. Barbara, welcome to the airwaves.
Thank you.
I'm so delighted to have you, and when I received the book, I thought, wow. We hear so much about this, and I, like so many other individuals, have been affected by this situation. I don't know of anyone in business, and I'm self-employed, that hasn't been affected. And I've seen recessions occur. I saw a major recession occur in Canada in the 80s. I saw a major recession occur in Alaska in the 90s. I have observed.
Oh, wow, you were in Alaska in the 90s.
Oh, yes. And
yeah, I didn't realize that.
They're just, I have so much work that has taken me up there for years. So when you see these plays of patterning with money and with the big kahunas of money that go into whatever arenas of activity they decide they're going to play into, it really is a fascinating drama, and this is nothing new in life. I mean, we've been affected by this in the United States more than once, and the most memorable is the Great Depression. And what I wanted to let my audience know about is that you have authored a number of books. You've written plays. You have been a contributor to many, many leading magazines. What made you decide to take this adventure of talking to people on the street and finding out what their circumstances were during this downtime?
Well, one thing, I had a suspicion that this was different than the normal recession. It's so sad to call recessions normal, but they are. And it was immediate. Apparent to me that it was different. It was different, A, in that almost everybody I talked to who had lost a house or a job or their savings during the recession had already been moving down. Their incomes over a long period of time had been either stagnant or declining in real terms, that is, adjusted for inflation. Mm-hmm. And they've been gradually acquiring debts that came to seem normal. I didn't interview a lot of the people that bought, you know, that were extravagant or so on, but just normal student debt that was well within range that they were sort of paying back, houses that were the price going in their neighborhoods. They weren't peculiar, but they were so far underwater once the crash came that they couldn't possibly move, or they couldn't sell their house, or they had to decide house or student debt. And I realized that this had been going on for building for the last 40 years, mm-hmm. because in order to get out of school and be in the situation where I was in the 1970s, people just had to have these debts. And I began to realize that over the 40 years that preceded this recession, people had our productivity had greatly increased, wages stayed the same, companies made lots and lots of money, which quite rightly, they put in the bank, they put in brokerage accounts, but they couldn't make the normal uses out of it. They couldn't use it to just expand their factories because they needed people to buy, and they didn't have those people to buy in the United States because they weren't paying them. So gradually they hit on the bright idea, I know what, instead of paying you to buy what you produce, I'll lend you the money. Well, that's a pretty short-range idea. I mean, if you don't have $10 this year, how will you have $15 next year to pay back with interest if you're not going to make any more money? So that led to this squeeze, to crazy lending, the last of which was the mortgage lending to people who couldn't afford houses. But I found that played into everything that I wrote, and it played into normal circumstances, too. I mean, yes, I talked to some people who lost their houses, and I was sitting there that evening, and they had no idea where they'd live the next day with four floors of furniture. But I also talked to people who, and that's an extreme situation, and the person's psychology is all bent out of shape, and she just couldn't realize it. She'd keep going back to the past and what this bank told her or didn't tell her, and she was ready to hire a lawyer and start again, even though, in fact, the judge had said to her, the house belongs to them. I don't want to hear another word from you. Mm-hmm. And so that's one psychological situation. But then I also talked to people who were so normal. In fact, I probably did one piece of good. I don't think my books do much good, to tell you the truth. But in one case, someone I knew called me and said, I wrote about a very ordinary couple. They went to one of them took out $80,000 worth of student loans, but you can't call him extravagant. He went through school straight, unlike me. He did 4 years, and then he did his BA, and they'd never been unemployed. They were two school teachers teaching in private high schools. Never been unemployed, but they had this student debt, and they were paying it $400 a month. Then they had done what else they were supposed to do. They bought a house in their area of D.C., and they bought one of the cheaper houses on the outskirts. But then came the crisis. They still hadn't lost their jobs, but they heard of more secure jobs in Minneapolis. But when they went to sell their house, if they managed to sell, they'd be $200,000 in debt. So they decided to take the gamble and move to Minneapolis anyway. Well, they were really nice people. They had one child. They wanted to have a second child. The parents were hoping they would. These people are completely normal. You couldn't find a nicer, more normal couple. And one of my friends called me up, and she said, you know, you helped me and my family a lot. I said, how? She said, well, I had been seeing my son and his wife, and I had been, without realizing, just how critical I was of them in my own mind, and they must have sensed it. Because to me, they were just failed yuppies. I don't like this food or that food that they eat, and so I think, oh, my goodness, look at this. I can't understand it. Two working people, and at the end of the month, they sometimes have to borrow, or they're taking out a little more to cover their mortgage. Or she said, I really thought they don't know how to manage. And I read your chapter on these two young people, and I said, wow, things have changed from when I got out of school. And I realized that I was being very judgmental and that the dollars and cents just didn't add up no matter what they did, whether they cut down on some of the things that I thought were silly to spend money on but were very minor, or they didn't. It doesn't add up. They're just not getting the same kind of break that I had when I started my adult life. And in that case, I'd say, she said, I confessed to them, and they realized that I had been judgmental, and I think the family got closer. Well, I'm sorry to say, that's probably the only good effect I've ever had, in the sense that I don't think policy changes because of what I write. I think few people feel a little better when they realize they're typical. Mm-hmm. And I think I helped this woman with her family. They're on better terms now.
Well,
because
one
she
of the things
unconsciously censorious.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I wanted to share with you, I had a conversation with a very, very dear lady I've known for a number of years. She is now 93 years young. I look at her and I'm just stunned. She is fabulous, and she is married to a man who is very wise with his money. And they're very comfortable. They're not excessively wealthy, but they're very comfortable. And she was sharing with me many of the circumstances of various people that they are around that are in their 80s, and how many of them have been affected because of what they had as savings. And we talked about the depression mind, because being 93, she had lived through that period of life.
Right, of course.
And she knew what that was like. And we were talking, just to go on the other side of the spectrum, about how she needed to do things for herself, even though she was 93, and especially when it came to wellness. And I said, you're worth it. And she said, it's very hard when you have gone through very difficult times and you've survived them to step away from the mentality, am I worth spending that money on? Oh, here we are in an environment today, and you bring out some of this in your down the up escalator, where many individuals that have gone through very difficult times have to make adjustments because they're not getting the income, or they do find themselves out of work, and how do they adapt to this? And I have some very, very special friends that are down in Southern California. They own a piece of property that's worth a great deal of money. They are close to 80 years of age. They had done everything by the book, and now they are living off basically what they call their savings, their principal. And of course, they hate to do that. But now, because of their age, the husband is very ill. She's looking at some serious situations. And she has that piece of property, and we talked about it, and she said, how could I leverage this? She said, it's all paid for, but it could be gone just for his medical expenses within a period of 2 years, if it's necessary, because of the costs in California. These are conversations that people are having. Now, one of the things I've observed...
And that's a conversation I'm afraid I don't have any magic solution for, either.
There isn't a magic solution for it. There really isn't. But it takes, I think, a resourcefulness. And that's what I wanted to bring out, because I think your book brings out some very different paradigm. And just like you talked about the family, the mother, saying, I need to change my attitude about certain things. On the other hand, the young can learn from those that have, like my friend who's 93 years young.
Right.
I mean, you listen to what she says. You pay attention, but you realize that this person has seen things and has experienced things and survived it, which we all can, but it's that resilience, that's resourcefulness that is necessary. That is what creates change, and that's what creates opportunity. And we are in one of the biggest switchbacks, I call it, that we've seen historically in a long time on so many levels, just huge switching of roles.
I'm afraid that what we're seeing is that this what to most of us is the result of a serious recession. I think one of the strange things in this recession is that in the course of the recession, usually businesses cut back, they take a little less profit, they compete on cost, and they keep their central workers and they keep their plant in repair to get going afterwards. And they do take a little less profit. During the course of this recession, profit rose by 25% from the very beginning in 2007 to when it was officially declared over. And in the course of the recession, people weren't just letting go a lot of staff and keeping central staff. They continued to take the jobs and make them less good. In other words, you didn't just lose your job. I talk to kids in New York. Kids, where do I say kids? People 45 years old, I'm calling a kid. But I talk to people, single people, who lost jobs as textbook editors or salespeople in a very fancy place where they made very high commissions.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of the recession, these people's hours were cut back, their commissions were taken away, the jobs were made into short-term jobs that you had for, you were told 2 weeks from now, every 2 weeks you were told what your hours would be for the next couple of weeks, 5 hours a day, 3 hours a day. And I said, well, did your employer thank you for helping them during the recession? They said, no. In both cases, the companies were still hiring. And they were saying to the full-time people that they had left, if you want to quit, go right ahead. We won't contest it with unemployment. In other words, you're gone. You can go if you want. Your benefit will be your unemployment insurance, which we won't contest. And we're taking in new people. One of the people said to me, oh, this is not temporary. They keep hiring new people. After this recession, not only will people not have the jobs they had before, but no one else will have those jobs. In other words, not on those terms. They'll be now part-time or what we call entrepreneurs, contract workers, the very person who is designing textbooks and graphics and doing computer work I don't understand for layout. It's not just that he won't have a job. It's that no one else will ever have such a job. The company is assuming that they will go on, assuming that the recession is temporary, but assuming that demoting people, changing what we used to think of as a real job into a real professional white-collar job into very much like blue-collar jobs have become over the last 30, 40 years. That's what the company was doing. I mean, they weren't suffering a recession. They were using a recession to make the company more profitable, which, of course, is every company's job, but not by expanding business. They couldn't expand the business if they weren't paying people over the whole country. They couldn't. So it's not the same as a recession. It's like a sort of retrenchment is a word they use, but it's sort of like collectively business people and financial people saying, well, this country's kind of downhill. Our market is abroad now. Our workers are abroad. We're not putting much into this country. We don't expect to recover. And it's really sad for the person in that circumstance. I mean, what are you? I mean, if you're not in this country, if you're not a wage earner, hardly, and you're not a consumer, and you're not making money off investments, it's like you're nobody, and being nobody is not a very nice feeling. And that's what I'm afraid is becoming temporary. I mean, I'm sorry.
That's
becoming permanent for a lot of people after the recession.
Well, there are so many times in history that we have major shakeups. It occurred at the beginning, when the 1800s merged into the early 1900s with industrialization, a lot of things disappeared. And what I'm finding very interesting are those people that have been indoctrinated, that could come from business school, without an understanding of how valuable a workforce is and how you can empower that workforce. There are those patternings that have been encouraged by quote-unquote business school. And there are so many companies that went overseas. And we had, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands, literally millions of jobs that went overseas. But now it seems like it is taking a shift. And I know that my husband was in conversation with someone, and there was a young man that was talking with him. And he said to him, he said, you have done so much in business and you have seen so many things in your lifetime. What would you say to me today? I'm getting ready to enter into this. I've gotten my master's degree in business. I'm of the entrepreneurial nature. My husband said, become acquainted with automation. Understand you're going to have to run a business effectively. And this young man was either going into the food industry or something where this was going to be important. And he said, fascinating. And so this is something that has created a big shift. And I know from interviews that I've done with people who have been in the blue-collar industry. They are begging.
But let me
workers.
Interrupt for a
yeah.
second. The young people that I'm talking to in New York, there's a group of people who found themselves unemployed at the same time in their church. All four of them realized that they were unemployed. So they formed something called the Pink Slip Club.
Mm-hmm.
And what they felt was to keep each other company and do inexpensive things in the city, go to free concerts in the afternoon, things as New Yorkers that they didn't get a chance to do while they were working full time. And for a few weeks, they were kind of, well, I won't say happy. They were shocked to be fired, to be laid off. But it became permanent. Those jobs never came back.
Mm-hmm.
But it took them for a while to realize that those jobs wouldn't come back. And remember, these were insurance adjusters, programmers, an editor of a trade journal, a person who did accounts receivable, which is a kind of bookkeeping broken down into segments for a huge media company. These were not industrial jobs, but they were being turned into industrial. Their skills were great. They had done what people were supposed to do, become computer workers in a post-industrial society. And the same work, and it was skilled work, and they kept learning new programs. But the same jobs were now being divided up so that if they could get the same job back, they would not have any benefits. They would be working part-time. Not only would they be poor, they couldn't pay for those apartments in Manhattan. They were already all taking in roommates. But they would be not really connected to the business that they had been part of before, because it would be 2 weeks here and 3 weeks there. So that's something that happened to blue-collar work. You mentioned 100 years ago. That's what's happening to white-collar work now.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a function of attitude, of can't fight back. It's not the job. The job is still skilled. The job is still a highly automated job. The job still needs a real person. I'm talking about jobs that can't be done from India because of the interaction with the rest of the staff and with the people that have to get paid. And you know, it's just power. It's sheer power. It's saying, I don't have to be good to you. You're going to come in and do this job well anyway, and I'm not going to be responsible for you in any way on the weeks or the hours that I don't need you. So that's a real change that our young people have to, oh, my God. I mean, you know, they've gotten mm-hmm. all those skills they need. They're racing. They have to take another year and another $20,000 worth of debt just to keep a year ahead on education so they can get a better job that hasn't been downskilled yet.
Well,
not
that
downskilled. The skill is just, I don't want to say that. The skill is just as great.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been degraded.
Well, and
that's a political
think,
question. That's power.
Mm-hmm.
We can't fight with it. It's a matter of fighting back.
I think that it is very challenging for any generation that has gone through this, and that's why my dear friend who's in her 90s, I really take time to listen to her carefully, because she's seen these waves. She has gone through them. She's lived through them. She's raised four or five children, and she's just had a phenomenal life as far as I'm concerned. But I think that these
and so
shifts,
will a lot of the people who are suffering from the recession. Life does go on.
Yes.
I don't want to give
it does go on. And it is that adaptation that goes on and taking skills that you have and being able to shift them. And again, your stories in your book about different people in different situations and down the up escalator, I think is really giving a very good perspective about the different generations and their capacity for being able to understand things. I talked with a gentleman that worked for a major car repairer. It's a national chain. And he ended up being laid off of his job. And he found that his skills could be used in a different way. And he ended up going to special training and it was with a state company that dealt with the utilities, and he had to go through specific training, and he said, I have had to reinvent myself, and this is a man who was in his late 40s, early 50s. And that's another thing that's occurred that we have seen in this cycle. We're seeing more and more mature people working. That
on a personal level, there's no doubt that the people that I've talked to who just go out for the fun and do anything, say this pink slip club that I talked about, a couple of people keep looking for the same kinds of jobs. And each time they're ready to take another $5,000 a year cut, they're not low enough yet. People are taking $10,000 or $20,000 yet. But the people who said, oh, I saw a sign up for a man who needed help in his record, doing some very archaic work, but he needed somebody to get his book straight. The person who did a little volunteer work or then did a little work, I'm not recommending that as something good for the health of the economy. Ultimately, it's bad. But the people who just take it as an adventure, well, I'd rather do something than nothing. I'd rather be helping than not helping. I'd rather have a place to go out to just go and sweep the front of the store every morning. They are personally better off, I noticed. Maybe they're personally better off because they're working, or maybe they were better off to start because they didn't take it so personally that it would make them too ashamed. You know, who am I if I'm just doing a job that really I should have been doing 40 years ago? That is much better personally. I mean, being part of the world in some way. But that's a personal advice I give to anybody I know. But and they don't all take it. Let me tell you, it's very. You have to be brave and take it as an adventure to have been some sort of professional and start helping out in the library, and the librarian's friend needs a little help somewhere, and you just, you know.
Being proactive.
You have to have
in
a
life.
Certain mentality and take that as an adventure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and that's the one thing about life. There are no guarantees, Barbara. There's just so much that can happen at any time, any place, anywhere, and I like your statement about look at life as an adventure, because this is something that is very important about living a life that has quality to it. And your book, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession, people can go to your website, downtheupescalator.com, downtheupescalator.com, and find out more about it. I would say that you have an interesting life, being able to gain perspectives from different aspects of observation. And I think that this book does everyone a service because you talk not just about the average individual, but also about some that were the rich and some that were the famous and how they were touched as well. So it is really a good read, and it's one that you want to think about when you go through it and not make any assessments or evaluations until actually you're finished with it. Barbara Garson, it has been a delight having you as a guest. Thank you.
Thank
for
you.
Being with me today, and keep up your writing.
Thank you.
And
okay.
Keep asking the questions. Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo. Check out downtheupescalator.com, a perspective about people, about life, and, well, a little bit more than what I think you would expect. Gives you an insight into how we as human beings can create, well, maybe our own reality, but sometimes we need to look at what is perceived as reality and, as she said, make it an adventure. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance your physical needs with your busy schedule is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors. A bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. It can be used anytime, anywhere. First thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. And as a weight loss appetite control. Only top-of-the-line and no genetically modified ingredients are used. No caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Visit Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information.
We see it every day. Courts overflowing with frivolous lawsuits. People losing all of their assets simply because they were unprepared. The best defense against unscrupulous predators and creditors is a good offense. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes and from all over the world create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Think asset protection is only for the wealthy? Think again. Our Cover Your Assets strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Industry leader Corporate Direct is owned and operated by attorney and best-selling author Garrett Sutton. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can tailor a CYA plan for you. That's CYA, Cover Your Assets, with Corporate Direct. 1-800-600-1760. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number, if you'd like to call in and chat with me, telephone lines are now open, is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And for those of you that are first-time listeners to the show, all I need is your first name or your initial. And, of course, after that, you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that might be concerning you. Well, I just wanted to share some information with you about how things evolve sometimes in the most unusual way. Now, we all know about Valentine's Day here in the United States. It's a huge holiday, and any excuse to have chocolate is a good thing to do. However, in the 1950s, when chocolate companies started talking to the people in Japan about celebrating Valentine's Day, something odd happened. There was a mistranslation. There was a candy maker that conveyed the message that it was customary for women to give chocolate to men on the holiday. Totally reversed of what we do in the U.S., but that's what they did. So they started the tradition. It caught on big. The Japanese women shower their men with chocolate treats on February the 14th, and then on March 14th, it's Valentine's Day for the ladies. The Japanese went and made it a bigger step. My goodness, all that chocolate flowing around. Lots of fun with that. I just thought I would share that little bit of trivia with you. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Who's going to be on with me this week? Well, we have quite an interesting lineup. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Betsy Thompson. Have you ever taken a positioning of thought? What happens if? What happens if? Well, Betsy's taken that positioning, and she's going to be sharing some insights with you on that. And then the Secret Life of Fathers. This month we are going to be celebrating Father's Day. James Bond is definitely a man who is going to have some perspectives. He's done a number of interviews with fathers and the way they feel about the relationships with their daughters, their challenges, etc., and I think you'll find it very enjoyable. Hidden truth about beautiful smiles. How many of us will listen to the ads regarding teeth whiteners, or we maybe have some problems with dental work? I learned so much from Dr. Zyback and his book, The Hidden Truth, about what's behind a beautiful smile. It was really quite interesting, and we're going to be sharing that information with you on Friday. So all of this and more is coming up on the Donna Sebo Show, and you can check the show information for the little bit of write-up about each author that is going to be coming up, and we do have a bunch of them. Are any of you classical musical lovers that are listening to the show today? Well, I'm sure you've been aware of the very famous movie Amadeus, which is all about the life of Mozart. Well, I came across some fascinating information about Mozart that I was not aware of. Now, Amadeus was Mozart's middle name, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. It was November the 20th, 1791. Mozart was swollen. He had been vomiting violently. He had a fever. He was partially paralyzed. Now, a few weeks before this date of November the 20th, 1791, he had expressed to his wife that he thought he was being slowly poisoned. He said, "I think someone's given me aqua tofana. I'm sure I have been poisoned, and I just cannot ignore this idea." Now, he had this overwhelming feeling of doom. He had the feeling that the Requiem Mass that he had been anonymously commissioned to compose was for his own funeral. And this is something that he couldn't shake. Now, he's only 35 years old when he died, and he was diagnosed with what is called a military fever at that time, whatever that was. Now, Mozart's life had been totally involved with political intrigue, and, of course, he had been a genius from the time he was a small child. He had battled with financial challenges most of his life and what they call royal backstabbing. A lot of court composers, remember, a lot of people, this is how they made their money, was off the gifts from the wealthy. This is how artists were able to make it. The court composers were very jealous of him because he had been a child prodigy. He was an exception. He wasn't the rule. So there was an Antonio Salieri, and he had been the court favorite until Mozart showed up. And that is all depicted in the movie Amadeus. Now, he was horribly jealous. Jealousy creates a lot of strange actions. Franz Hofdamel, who thought his wife Magdalena may have been involved with Mozart in an intimate way. And also, there were rumors that the Freemasons had marked Mozart for death because he had revealed some of their secrets in the opera, The Magic Flute. Now, after his death, the symptoms of poisoning were very obvious. However, no autopsy was done, and the funeral was done on a day when the weather was very, very bad, and his grave was never marked. To this day, they still do not know where Mozart was buried. And maybe if they ever found out, probably not after all of this time, they might have been able to determine the actual cause of death. But that just adds a little bit more mystery to a man who has brought joy and beauty to billions of people since his life in the 1700s. Just a little bit of something in the way of trivia and mystery for you to chew on today. It's summertime here in the Pacific Northwest. Oh my goodness, we have got the sun out. It's going to be 80 degrees today. We are just tap-toeing with joy here in the Pacific Northwest because we have had rain. Of course, the temperatures have been a little bit warmer, but it's just such a joy to see the golden glow filling the sky, and it's just marvelous. Well, of course, when you have warm weather like that, what are you going to see? You're going to see swarms of bugs. Yes, and what is the wonderful, wonderful, buzzing personality that we always have to make sure we don't give habitat to? That is our ever-friendly, oh, what do I want to call it, buzzer, the mosquito. The mosquito is one of the insects that is a carrier of so many challenges, microbes, organisms, and often when we're bitten, we can, if depending on where you are in the world, the seemingly lonely mosquito, and by the way, it is the female that does the biting, not the male, but when she does, sometimes it can create major problems. So we humans have realized that we've got to keep mosquitoes at bay. So we want to make sure that we don't have any standing water around. And here in the Pacific Northwest, that's a job. You really have to make sure that if you've had any containers that have been outside, that if they've become filled with water, like we've had so much rain, or we have stagnant areas where the water just sits, those are breeding grounds, as we all know, for mosquitoes. But I learned something just yesterday that I was not familiar with. It actually is the carbon dioxide that we exhale that attracts mosquitoes. Now that is, to me, some fascinating information. Who would have thought the carbon dioxide we exhale would be the attractor? One of the things they've found in research about the lonely mosquito is that if you're out, you're doing a jog, you're sweating, mosquitoes love that. Apparently, you smell real good to them. So don't be surprised if you find yourself getting bitten by mosquitoes, especially when you're perspiring very, very heavily. Also, pregnant women, if they put off a lot of carbon dioxide. So that's just the way it is. And they just really are attracted to any environment that's going to have a high level of humidity. And if you, like me, have lived in areas, let's say like Florida or been in the tropics, you swear the mosquitoes they've got there are 777. They come in, you can hear the buzz, and man, you've got to make sure. Michigan is known for it too. They're humdingers. But the ones sometimes that have the biggest chompers are the ones you can't see. In Alaska, they're called no-see-ems. And I had an experience once where I actually was in the middle of a swarm of baby mosquitoes. The sky was black with them. I have never, ever had an experience like that since. I was with a very dear friend of mine, Sal, and he was a biologist for the state of Alaska. And he was showing me some areas there, and we were by a swamp area, which was just beautifully occupied by swans. We were seeing beluga whales out in the main water area that this swamp water would flow out to. And the wild birds, oh, they were just beautiful to see. Well, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's this massive, massive black ball. It happened so fast. The hatching occurred with a rapidness that was incredible. And I was stunned. He said, told me to get in the vehicle, and he said, we're going to get moving, roll down the window, which we did, and the air blew them out of the vehicle. It was an incredible experience, but they hadn't been around long enough to recognize that the humans that they had come in contact with were fresh meat, so to speak. They were there. Well, the fish feed on them. The birds feed on them. It's an amazing thing. But be sure you use what is called a DEET repellent, because DEET actually does do the job. And they also, apparently, mosquitoes are repelled by lemon eucalyptus, and it's a compound IR3535. They're a little bit weaker than the DEET. And I know that we don't like to use chemicals very often, but if you have little ones out, depending on where you are, or yourself, I mean, I have to make sure I stay in, because at 5 o'clock they, here in our part of the world, they come out at 5 in the afternoon at dusk when it's starting to get a little bit cooler. And they, I swear, they have napkins around their necks and knives and forks in their handy little feet. because they are ready to munch. They don't like my husband for some reason, but they think I'm great. So I have to make sure that I'm not out at that time. This is Donna Siebel. We're going to take a break for a minute. If you would like to give me a buzz, 888-627-6008. We're going to be right back.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance your physical needs with your busy schedule is always a challenge. Amino muscle snack time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino muscle snack time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors. A bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. It can be used anytime, anywhere. First thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. And as a weight loss appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used. No caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon or squatsponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding amino muscle snack time by visiting Amazon.com or squatsponge.com. Visit Amazon.com or squatsponge.com for more information.
Too many people become victims of frivolous lawsuits and scammers simply because they were unprepared. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Asset protection is not only for the wealthy. Our strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can help you. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Hi, this is Donna, and if you want to chat with me, 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call into. We have a caller on the line. Let's go to that caller. Thank you for waiting. This is Donna Siebel. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Hi, my name is Peg F., and I'm calling from Massachusetts.
From Massachusetts. Welcome. Where
yes.
in Massachusetts?
Thank you.
Where are you calling?
Massachusetts is on the other side of the country.
No, I know you, but what area in Massachusetts?
Oh, right, central Massachusetts, where, let's say, Worcester, the biggest city would be Worcester. So we're, like, right in the central area of Massachusetts. I'm in Sterling, Massachusetts.
Wonderful. Well, I'm so delighted that you've been able to join us.
Like half an hour away, but yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you and see what things you have to say.
All right, dear. So let's get started. And there's a little bit of a time delay. I wanted to let you know that. So just be aware that there's that little bit of time delay, and just sort of take a quick breath after I finish, and then you can jump right in, all right? That way we won't be talking over each other. Wonderful. Let me give you some information right off the bat. The first thing that is coming into my mind is that you must become more organized. There are too many loose ends around you, and you're needing to put things into their right positioning. And you keep getting sidetracked. You keep getting distracted by people and circumstances. And I would love for you to develop a patterning where maybe you give yourself, let's say a half hour in the morning. And this is an example. You can do it anytime you want. But just give yourself a half hour and maybe have a cup of coffee or tea and just say, okay, I really have to pull myself in. Let me put out my to-do list, and I'm going to do two things on it, and I'm going to get those two things done. And then if I don't get my to-do list done, I'm not going to give up. I'm just going to put it aside for the next day, and then I'll get to two other things. But I feel like there is a part of your environment that keeps coming in and overwhelming you. It could be friends, it could be family, it could be a number of different things. And you are needing to say, no, I'm not going to be able to make this commitment. I am having to take care of certain things. And once I'm finished with finishing what I need to do, then I'll be happy to talk about it. And I am seeing a female in your environment that can be very, very demanding, almost childlike. And this is someone, you don't have to be rude to the person, but you can say, you're going to have to wait, just like we have to do with children. They can't be instantly gratified. You have to say, you're going to need to wait. We're not going to be able to do this. If you didn't have money to do something, if they wanted money or whatever, you have to say, this is not possible at this time. And always use the words at this time, because what it does, they go, oh, well, you're so negative and you're thinking, no, 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 this is the way it is at this time. And then gently retreat. And you're going to find that you're going to be able to bring your life into a balance that you really want. And I'm seeing you as a very strong woman. I'm looking at you as someone that has often been in what I'd call the caretaking position. And this is time for you to take back your own power. This is time for you to say, I want to be able to make my life work the way it should. And so you're taking these little tiny baby steps over the next 3 months. And they're baby steps because that is the best way for you to do it, so that you don't have tremendous upheaval in your life. And those baby steps, once they're done consistently, they then become a habit. And you're going to be very pleased with the results. But it's going to take some time for you to get to this positioning. It's just one day at a time, one step at a time. One day at a time, one step at a time. And you're going to be very pleased with how stable and steady your life is going to be in September. Do you have a quick question for me, dear? I'm looking at the clock, and I know I've only got about a minute and a half.
Yeah, I do have a... Everything you've said is just right on spot. And I know exactly what you're talking about and, you know, who you're talking about. And my quick question is I'm having trouble with my spirituality, and I feel that I just can't seem to get it, and I just don't know what I'm doing wrong.
You're not doing anything wrong. You're not doing anything wrong, dear. What I think you are aspiring for is totally already there. But you're trying so hard. You're trying so hard to fit yourself into a box. And it's very difficult for me to get this all together in 30 seconds, but let me put it to you this way.
I know.
You are whole. You're complete. What you are doing is a journey of self-discovery. And I want you to be okay with where you are, because you're not lost and you're not wandering and you have not failed. You actually are in the process of growing. And what I said to you earlier is part of that process. And I think that which you perceive as spirituality is going to grow into really its completeness within you, so that you feel that harmony that you want.
Right.
It's happening for you now, dear. It is happening for you now. Just take one day at a time, one step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You're there.
That makes much sense to me, Donna. Thank you very, very much.
You're
I feel
welcome.
Better already.
That is
much
wonderful.
Better,
wonderful, dear. I've got to go. I'm sorry I have to cut you off, but I must go. This is Donna Sebo. We are out of time. Hey, I'm going to be back with you tomorrow. And the what-ifs in life, we're going to be addressing that. Remember, always you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a magnificent life and a fabulous day. This is Donna Siebel. We'll be with you tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.